We are going to today finish the book of 1 Samuel, and we are going to review the first section of David's life. David's life actually breaks into a number of very clearly identifiable sections. This section today begins with his anointing by Samuel in chapter 16 and ends at chapter 28 and 29 when David rescues the city of Ziklag and Saul dies, and then we'll look at what proceeds. Now, this period of time is about 4.5 years. Let me give you something that will really shock you. David, during this first period of time, is only 17 to 22.5 years of age. We know that counting back, and we'll see that next week. This particular time period, this 4.5 year time period, is broken into two sections, and that's what we're going to look at today, emphasizing chapter 27. Roman numeral 1, in your outline, David's rise as a national leader, chapter 16, all the way over to chapter 17, verse 31. The writer wants you to see how David came to be from a shepherd to the most important figure in the nation. During these chapters, in this short period of time, Samuel anoints him as king. He kills Goliath. He becomes to Saul the king, a bodyguard, musical therapist, commander of the army, and the son-in-law to the king. Chapter 18, verse 5 says he's successful in all that he does. On top of this, everybody loves the man. Chapter 18, verse 16 says, "And all Israel and Judah loved David. King Saul loved David. Jonathan loved David. Michael loved David. All Judah and Israel loved David. The women would go out and sing with their tambourines and songs. They would say, 'Saul kills 1,000, David kills 10,000. He is known now nationally. If there was a who's who of military leaders and political leaders, David would be at the top of the list. He takes the nation by storm during a one-year period of time. It's a delightful period of time, but it only lasts a very short period. During this rise to national prominence, Saul becomes more and more jealous of him. And we read in chapter 18, verses 8 and 9, "Now, what more can he have but that the kingdom, and Saul eyed David from that day." Jealousy enters into the heart of Saul. Rather than seeing David as an asset to his kingdom, he sees him as a threat. And so we see now this growing tension between the king and his chief servant. One day David is prized. He's near the king. He plays his instrument. He's at the king's table. And the next minute a spear is thrown at him. He runs. During this short period of time, confusion is the chief word in David's life. During this short time period, Saul plays this cat and mouse game with David. David is partially hiding from Saul, partially present and very active in the kingdom. Some days at the king's table, other days literally hiding in the woods. Now this short period of time ends with your Roman numeral number 2, and that is David as fugitive running from King Saul. Chapter 20, verse 21 is the permanent break between Saul and David. This is the second section now of this first period in David's life. And the key verse is verse 31. We read this: "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die." This text is at the very heart of Saul's philosophy. Saul understands something. This David is risen to national prominence, and everyone loves him, and everything he does is successful, and God is with him. He must die. He is going to secure his future, his dynasty, and his throne through Jonathan, and so the only way to do that is to kill the usurper, as he sees him. Now, he has been told by Samuel 3 times that the kingdom has been taken away from him and given to another, but he will not listen to that. Here is a man exerting his own will on the will of God. Now, at this point, David becomes number one FBI most wanted man in Israel. There is a price tag on his head. And this period of time lasts somewhere between 2.5 and 3 years. It could even go a little longer, but some period like that when he is a fugitive. Now, remember, he's a man only in his early 20s, 21, 22. By 22.5, he is now going to be made king of Judah. During this period of being a fugitive, he is being prepared to be the king, and he is prepared for the spiritual writings that he will do, and we'll look at these in the weeks ahead. The key word in this period of time is rejection. He is rejected by the king. Now, while he is a fugitive, important lessons are learned and important events take place. I want to look at these events and tie together 15 chapters that we have looked at. Thank you, Will, for giving me the time to do this. Number one in your outline, David builds an army of mighty men. Now, you won't see that now, but you go over to 2 Samuel 23, 1 Chronicles 11, and you will see that he builds a substantial force, fighting force. David is such a beautiful person. His character, his loveliness, he draws people like a magnet to him. He draws troubled and hurting people who would normally be rejected by important figures like him. He draws all kinds of people. Look at chapter 22, verse 2. And everyone who was in distress, and anyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became captain over them. So he has 400 men now. This is sort of a ragtag army at this point. Now, David, in a few short years, will become king of Judah, and then he will eventually become king of all Israel. A king needs an army. He needs an army because he is surrounded by hostile nations like the Philistines and the Amalekites and others. And he's going to have to fight a civil war for 7 years with the north. So he's got to have fighting men. And he's got to have a group of men who will follow him and listen to him and have some competency. Now, we normally hear people talk about David's ragtag army. This marauding group of men that travel through the south of Judah. And they're just, you know, vagabonds. That's half true, and that is true. In fact, later in Samuel, we're told some of these men were wicked and worthless men. No one else would have them. David took them. But that's only half the story. The other half of the story is what the Bible calls David's mighty men, a smaller group. There was a dedicated group of men who were extremely competent in war who drew themselves to David, and then the army goes up to 600 from the 400. I remember when I was about 15 or 16 years of age, Paul Sapp, who was once the camp director here at Camp Elam, took me to a conference in New York State. Beautiful, old, 100-year-old farmhouse that had been redone, renovated, and we had this conference in this old farmhouse with one of the heads of the Navigators. And the entire weekend, this speaker spoke on David's mighty men. And I will never forget that as he took us through every one of the mighty men of David and how incredible they were. Well, the head of the army was Joab. Joab is actually his nephew. He's the commander of all. He is an awesome man. He's also a pain in the neck at times, but he's an awesome leader. Then there are three in the inner circle, very powerful men, Josheb, Eleazar, and Shammah. Josheb, in one battle, himself, by swinging a sword, killed 300 men. 800 men, excuse me. 800 men he killed just by himself. And then there are two others in the inner circle, Abishai and Benaiah. Abishai, we are told, swung his sword and through taking his sword and going back and forth like that, killed alone 300 men. Now, this Benaiah, we're told more things about Benaiah. The Bible says he was mighty in deeds. The Bible goes on to say this in 1 Chronicles 11, 22. He also went down and killed a lion inside a pit on a snowy day. So here's this one man going into a pit and he kills a lion. That's a pretty powerful guy. And then we're told in verse 23, he killed an Egyptian who was over 7 feet tall. He had hands like a weaver's beam, but he went down to him with a club and snatched the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. Then we're told that a group of people came from the tribe of Gad to help David. These are people who sense David is God's choice and they want to help him during these years of being a fugitive. So we read in 1 Chronicles 12:8. Look at these words right in back of me. These are the men from the tribe of Gad. They voluntarily come to David. Mighty men of valor. In other words, they're men of courage. They're brave soldiers. Men trained for war. They weren't just a group of incompetents who had nothing to do, owed some debt, and said, let's just link up with David. He'll provide a nice living for us. No, these are trained men for war. They're soldiers who could handle a shield and spear and whose faces were like the faces of lions. My wife says I have a face like a pussycat. So I'm not among these men. And she said meaner things, but I won't tell you those right now. And they are swift as the gazelles on the mountains. These men remind me of that commercial we see of the Marine. You know, he's got that buzz hairdo, and he's got this big giant jaw and just these huge monster shoulders. And the advertisement, the Marines just want a few good men. Well, David had some very good warriors. Later, more come. In fact, some come who are actually not only great warriors, but they're men who understand the times. Men who grasp culture and what is happening. Now, this man who gave us this whole weekend lecture on David's mighty men applied it this way. In the New Testament, God wants mighty men and women. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 and 11, we're told, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the full armor of God. Take the shield of God and the sword of God, which is the word of God. One of the great privileges we have had as a church, and we take no credit for it, it's God's doing, is that God has, from the very beginning, given us mighty men and women of God in this church. People of the word. People of courage. People will stand for conviction and will be faithful and endure the work. From the very beginning. A friend of mine told me this story. He had graduated from Gordon Conwell Seminary and he lived in Long Island. And he expected when he finished his seminary, he would go and become a pastor in Long Island where he lived. Well, he finished his seminary, went back to Long Island, and the first week he was there, someone called him and said, we have a church right near your house that needs a pastor for 6 months. Will you fill in? He said, sure, I have nothing else to do. So he filled in for 6 months. When he got done, someone says, we have a church right in the area here that needs a pastor for 8 months. Will you come? He says, oh, sure, I'll come. I have nothing to do. And then for the next 11 years, his only job was fill-in pastor, interim pastor until they found a pastor. Over a cup of coffee, he told me this story. He said, I've learned something in 11 years. When the pastor leaves, the whole thing falls apart. There isn't a single male in the church that can open the Bible, instruct the church, lead the church, or carry on what has happened in the years past. It's like no one has graduated from school. They're all still spiritual babes. And we start all over at point one. That's failure. The will of God is that we grow up and mature and become strong. So if right now I drop dead on this stage, well, have a good funeral for me. But the church won't stop. We have plenty of mighty men in this church who can teach the word, lead this church, carry on everything that needs to be done. That's what the Lord wants. He wants mighty men and women of God. Not squashes. He wants good redwoods and sequoias. People who can stand up tall and carry the work of God. Be a mighty man, a mighty woman of God. Know your Bible. P.T. Forsyth said this, one man who truly knows his Bible is worth more to a church than a group of people who don't. Number two, David develops his leadership skills. During this period of time, he is going to prepare himself for being the king and leading many, many people, thousands of people. There's a marvelous verse in Psalm 78, and here it is on the screen in back of me, verses 71 and 72. He chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds and to shepherd Jacob, his people. Two characteristics, with upright heart, he shepherded them. Now, please look at these words. They're beautiful words. and guided them with his skillful hand. I love that little phrase, a skillful hand. Skillful in what way? Skillful in handling people and leading. He was skilled in personal relationships, dealing with all kinds of people in very difficult situations. He was a skilled man. Now, can you imagine, you've got 400 new soldiers. Then it goes up to 600. You've got some that the Bible said are evil and wicked. You've got some that are highly competent, valiant men. How do you keep them all together without killing one another and starting four or five other groups? And he had to provide food for them, work for them. They were under a lot of stress. They were running for their lives most of the time. He had to lead them. He had to motivate them, and he had to keep them as a united body. That takes skill. Chapter 30, verse 26, we're told an interesting story. If you want to look at chapter 30, verse 26, David had just defeated the Amalekites who had raided Ziklag, and he takes this great deal of booty back with them, and he does this. Then David came to Ziklag, and he sent part of the spoil to his friends. Did you notice that word? His friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here is a present for you from the spoils of the enemies of the Lord. After he has this stunning victory over the Amalekites, he very wisely sends gifts. He has camels and he's got goats and sheep, and they've gotten many other possessions from the Amalekites. And to the elders of the different cities of Judea, he sends them all a gift. David was a man with a lot of friends, but you know how to keep friends. He was a generous man, shared with them. Those would be the elders who would, in a very short time, next week, make him king of Judah. So he's got some savvy with people, and he understands people and the importance of maintaining relationships and not burning bridges. And then we're told in this very same chapter that after they had this stunning victory over the Amalekites and they came back with this enormous amount of goods, that some of the men, the worthless and evil, wicked men, said, well, not everyone went to battle. Some stayed with the hardware and with the city, they don't get anything. They didn't go to battle. David immediately speaks up and courageously says this in verses 22 to 24. And David said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that each man may lead his wife and his children and depart. That's what the wicked men said. And David said, you shall not do so, my brothers. With what the Lord has given us, he has preserved us and given into our hands the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this manner? In other words, no one's going to listen to you anyway. For as his share is who goes down into battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall all share alike. Very fair, very honest man speaks up. He says, no, everybody is going to share in the bounty, not just those who were in the battle. You know how that makes people feel? I once heard an interview with a very successful prison warden. And they actually interviewed prisoners because this man had become a model of a prison leader. And so they asked the prisoners, what is it about this warden that he's done such a marvelous job? And the answer from the prisoners was, he's very fair to everybody. He listens to people. He doesn't just jump to conclusions. So David was a very fair man, and he was a man of peace, a man that could keep the troops and inspire the troops and be a real model to them. Now let me just say this to you. God wants you to build your relationship skills. Do you know the New Testament is full of information about relationships? Full. All kinds of principles are in the New Testament about humility and forbearance and about bearing with one another and gentleness. There's this incredible amount of information about how we relate to one another, how we're going to live with one another in this sinful, broken up world. One of the results of Adam and Eve's sin is fighting, human warfare. The whole history of the human race can be described in warfare. And the history of the Church of Jesus Christ, sadly, can be described in terms of warfare and division. George Verwer says, a church at peace is an oasis in a desert. He often says when he goes into the church, he's not in there 5, 6, 7 minutes, and someone wants to take him aside. Do you know what's going on here? You need to know this. As if he did. I heard of several missionaries in the country, the little tiny country of Luxembourg, right in the center of Europe. And I was at a table listening to this conversation. And these missionaries, as they look back at the past 100 years in Luxembourg and the complete failure of the work of the gospel in Luxembourg, they tried to figure out, why have we made such little progress? One of the conclusions they made was it was a missionary graveyard. Missionaries were not getting along with one another. They were fighting one another. They became their own worst enemies. And so this band of new missionaries wrote up a draft of a document, a covenant, that any missionary coming into Luxembourg as an evangelical, whatever group he's in, would read the principles, all taken out of the Bible, of how we missionaries are going to relate to one another. How we're going to handle problems when we hear rumors and tale-bearing. And this brought a great deal of success to their present work. So we all should be growing in our relationship skills, growing in our ability to handle disagreement and problems among one another, and to operate in a Christian manner, the missionary graveyard. Missionaries were not getting along with one another. They were fighting one another. They became their own worst enemies. And so this band of new missionaries wrote up a draft of a document, a covenant, that any missionary coming into Luxembourg as an evangelical, whatever group he's in, would read the principles, all taken out of the Bible, of how we missionaries are going to relate to one another. How we're going to handle problems when we hear rumors and tale-bearing. And this brought a great deal of success to their present work. So we all should be growing in our relationship skills, growing in our ability to handle disagreement and problems among one another, and to operate in a Christian manner following Christian principles. Now this brings us to number three. David learns many spiritual lessons. If I do not finish this today, do not worry, I'll go into next week. This is the heart of this three-year period as a fugitive. During this 3 years, God is going to teach him some of the most valuable lessons. He will repeat them throughout the Psalms. They will be the foundation to his kingship later. So I don't want to rush through this. A, in your outline, the dangers of discouragement. Now we're going to look at chapter 27 in just a moment. It is the lowest point in David's life. It is really, in a sense, the conclusion before he becomes king. The constant pressure of Saul chasing him, not being able to rest or have a normal life, drives David into this state in which he's overwhelmed by the thought of death and Saul killing him. In fact, in chapter 20, verse 3, he says to Jonathan, his friend, on one occasion, "As your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." That's a bad statement, by the way. Now, what is it about David that at this point he becomes so discouraged that he actually, for a year and 4 months, leaves Judea and he goes over to the side of the enemy and he lives that 16-month period in Philistine territory and subjects himself to the Philistine king Achish? What could have done this? Well, I want to just make a conjecture at this point. I think weariness led to discouragement. Weariness can make us do strange things. He was weary because his beloved mentor and father in the faith, Samuel, had died. Many people had been killed over him. Ahimelech, the high priest, had been killed because of David. 85 priests of Nob were killed because of David. He had that on his conscience. It was because of his lie, by the way. He has no home right now. He's responsible for 600 men and their families and children. Where do you provide food for that many people? How do you keep them content? Fellow tribesmen from Judah, from the section called Ziph, betray him and report to Saul, "He's in Ziph, come and get him." That must have hurt. We read about that in the Psalms. People slandered him to Saul. We know that from 1 Samuel, we know it from the Psalms. There were people who were on the payroll with Saul and from his tribe that did not want Saul to step down as king. They wanted that dynasty to go on. It was to their advantage. And they were slandering David all the time, saying something like this, because we'll hear it later. "David just wants your throne, that's all. He just wants your money. He just wants your position. He's a man, he's a greedy man after power." So he was being slandered. He was also young and inexperienced. And he's already had several big disappointments and big failures. And lastly, this had lasted for years, several years. Now, at this point in David's life, we must come to chapter 27, and this explains how he's going to handle his discouragement and his weariness. And we read in verse 1, this is an incredibly important verse, so please focus in on it. Now, I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Now, let's look at this verse. Very important. First, he says this, I shall perish one day by the hands of Saul. False. Totally false. Totally misleading him. God had told him he will be king. Samuel, his beloved mentor, the great prophet, said, you will be king. Jonathan, his dear friend, said, you will be king. Abigail prophesied, you will be king. And King Saul himself, at a moment of renewal, says, it is obvious you will be king. The promise of God that he would be king came through many sources to David. God made a promise. You are the next king. And David says, I'm going to perish. It's obvious. He's going to kill me. He's a crazy man. He was a crazy man. He was literally a homicidal maniac. He killed the high priest and killed 85 priests. This is a serious, dangerous man. This is not just some simple cat and mouse game. This man will stop at nothing. He even tried to kill his own son. Notice the second thing he says. There's nothing better for me to do. Go to the Philistines. The enemies of God. The enemies he's been fighting. I have no other choice. What else can a poor man do? I'll go down with the Philistines. Be a nicer life down there. I'll take my whole group, family down there. Actually, this choice turns out to be a catastrophe. He would have been better to stay near Saul than to go down with Achish and Gath, because it will be ruinous to him. He was wrong on every count. And the reason he was wrong is because he didn't believe God. It's just really that simple. He did not believe God's promise. You're going to be king. So we read in verse 1 that David listened and reasoned in his own heart. Now, this is an important statement, because there is no evidence that David prayed at this point. Up until now, we've seen some key points where David prays. We're going to see him pray at the end. He does not pray about this. He doesn't say to Abiathar, bring the ephod. Let's seek counsel from the Lord. He reasons in his heart. I'm as good as dead. Saul is going to win one of these days. And there's nothing better for me to do. I'll just go down there. So he's not reasoning properly, because he's discouraged and he's weary and he's falling back on his worst resources, not prayer. So David goes down, chapter 27, verse 2. So David arose and went over, he and his 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maach, king of Gath. Gath is where Goliath is from. Gath is the city he was to earlier and made a complete fool of himself when he acted like a madman so he wasn't killed by Achish. He goes down to the enemy city. It's going to get worse. While he's in this enemy city of Gath, which is a royal city, it's a prominent city. Achish is a very prominent man. He does come up with one good idea. It's a little hot in this city, and so he makes the suggestion to Achish, could I have a city of my own? I've got 600 men and their families, so he's probably got 1,000 or 2,000 people with him. Look at verse 5. And David said to Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country's towns that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you? It's like, you know, your in-laws. You don't want to live with your in-laws. You know, just maybe 25 miles away. You know, you like your in-laws, but 20, there's a little buffer. You need that buffer. Helps. That's what he's saying. Give me some buffer between you and the royal city. So that day, Achish gives him Ziklag, very important city in the life of David. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. Now, and the number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. Get that. Basically, out of this 4.5-year period, 16 of those months, he spends in a backslidden condition in enemy-occupied territory as a servant to Achish. Now, David asks for a city, he gets Ziklag. Now, if you look on the map up here, you'll see Ziklag where it is. Ziklag is far south, down near the Gaza Strip. is 25 miles south of Gath. So he's got some buffer between himself and Achish. Now, the wonderful thing about the Bible is that the Bible does not hold back the truth of people. David is a hero. He's a real, genuine hero. But he has some big flops. Failures of the first proportion. And this is, he's entering into it now. I want to just give you the background to this major failure, because this is what's interesting. He's in a period of vacillation. He does good things and bad things, good things and bad things. He goes down now. He's in this city of Ziklag. He's going to do raids all around this entire southern area. He's going to kill a lot of people. But just before he enters his 16-month period, he has one of his, if not greatest, victories. Chapter 26. Notice how these two stories are just put right up against each other. In chapter 26, David soars to the height of victory. Now, here's what he does. One night, he and Abishai, who is one of his mighty men, one of the top inner circle of mighty men, creep into the camp where Saul is sleeping, chasing David. And there's a supernatural sleep that falls upon Saul and Abner, his right-hand general, and all the men that are camped right around Saul. So Saul's in the center, sound asleep, right around him are all his bodyguards and chief commander. David goes in at night and takes his sword and his water jar. Now, just look at this with me. Verse 12, chapter 26, verse 12. So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man knew it or saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. So they were sort of like drugged. Then they slip out of camp, goes over to a little hillside, far enough away they can't get a hold of him, and yells out at night and wakes them all up. Middle of the night. You know, that's horrible. And David yells out this, "Abner! Are you a man? Abner!" And he's got Saul's spear and water jug. And then he reminds Abner of something. The price to pay if you allow the king's life to be jeopardized. And what is that price? Death. The bodyguards die with the king. That's what happens later. The bodyguards are sound asleep while David has a sword inches from Saul's throat. And so David throws them on them. They should actually be put to death at this moment. Saul realizes it's David's voice. And if you think about it, it's just a stunning story. Right there in Saul's presence, and he can take his spear and take his water jug and slip out. Slip in and slip out. And he spares Saul's life. He could have killed him at that moment. Anyone else would have killed him. In fact, Abishai says to David, when they're right there, hearing him breathing and snoring, "Kill him now. God has delivered him into your hands." And David says for the second time, "No, I will spare his life." Now look at what Saul says in verse 21. Follow me now. "Then Saul said, 'I have sinned.'" Now get this. "Return my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake." Verse 25. "Then Saul said to David, 'Blessed are you, my son.'" He gives a benediction to him. "You will do many things and will succeed in them." David went his way and Saul returned to his place. David has this wonderful victory and Saul says, "I've made a mistake. Return to the land. I will not harm you." Now, I wouldn't listen to that because he's already said this. So that was not something David was going to do. Now, you would think at this point David would be going hip-hopping down the road going, "I had him inches within my hands. Oh, what a feeling when Abner's, oh, I could have just died to see Abner's face. He's just sitting there. Looks like, wishing this day never occurred." And they're all just horrified and shocked that David is right in the camp there with him and escapes. With the very sword, probably, and spear that he tried to kill David with at another time. What a victory. What a victory. What a story. What a hand of God. And the Lord did put him to sleep. Now, it's right after that moment that he goes down to Ziklag, goes down to Gath. Does that make any sense to you? No, it doesn't to me, but I know life, and I know myself. That's what we're like. We have these great victories, and then down we go. He was basically worn down. He was basically discouraged. He was tired of the whole thing. We get tired of life. We get tired of the battle. That's normal. When I was in Ireland a few weeks ago, I was with some very, very good Christian people. Husband and wife stayed in their home. Very wonderful couple. Served the Lord all their life. And late at night, we got chatting, and they let the cat out of the bag. We're just tired. We've been hurt. Some of our friends have really hurt us. And I sat there and I listened to them tell how some very terrible things happened in the church to them and some terrible criticism laid against them. People tried to clear it up later, but it was too late. They were tired. They were worn out, weary, discouraged. You just want to walk away from it all. So we all get that, particularly if we serve the Lord and try to do things for the Lord. So expect it. Don't be caught off guard by this. David got caught off guard. He's young. He's inexperienced. He doesn't understand. He didn't understand what to do. He's going to find out what to do, but the hard way. So we have this great victory, and now we have this terrible defeat. David goes to Ziklag. Now, in chapter 27, verse 8, while David is living in Ziklag, he starts doing raids through this whole south area down here. These are probably Canaanites. And, well, he's got to provide food for his men. There weren't jobs. They couldn't just go and get a job. How do you feed 1,000 people, 2,000 people? So they start raiding these towns and wiping them out, basically. Look at verse 8. Now, David and his men went up and made raids against the Geshurites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites. For these were the inhabitants of the land from of old. That's why I say they were probably Canaanites, many of them. And God had put a ban on them. They were to be destroyed. And Israel didn't follow what God said. As far as Shur to the land of Egypt. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive. It was very cruel. And would take away the sheep and the oxen, the donkeys and the camels and the garments and come back to Achish. In other words, he'd bring this huge booty back from all these towns he raided and massacred everyone. And when Achish asked, "Where have you made a raid today?" David would say, "Against Negeb of Judah." He lied to him right to his face and said, "I've been going over here to the Jews, going over to my fellow Israelites and raiding towns in Judah." That was not true. Now it gets worse. David's character, David's witness as a servant of God is being decimated in front of Achish. As the story progresses, Achish almost looks like a man of greater character than David at this point. In fact, Achish really falls in love with David. There must have been something about David that was just so charismatic and so appealing that Achish says, "You know, I'm going to make you my bodyguard. You've been like an angel to me," he says. Now, David gets a real shock here, and the hand of God is going to come down on him. The hammer's about ready to fall. When Achish comes to him in chapter 28, verse 1, "Now, those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel, and Achish said to David, 'Understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army.' And David said to Achish, 'Very well, you shall know what your servant can do.'" Achish says to him, "The entire Philistine army, with all the different cities and all the different warlords of the Philistines, are mounting a major attack on Israel, and you're going to go with me and go to the battle line." And David says, "You'll see what I can do." What a predicament. Now he's got to fight directly. He can't lie his way out of this one. He's going to have to go to war, and Achish right by his side. This is a test. He fails the test when he says, "I'm your servant. I'm going to go to war against the people of God." These are the enemies of God right here. He's been fighting them in his early days. Now, God intervenes and helps him not to do this because it would have been a horrible thing. When the other Philistine warlords see that David is with Achish, they go, "Oh, he is not going to war with us, because if he gets out there and turns coat on us, why, Saul and the others will think, oh, what a great man. He comes from the back and helps us. We will not have David. We know who David is." They sing of Saul, "He kills 1,000, David kills 10,000. No, the warlords say, "You cannot go." Achish is really sorry about this, and so in verse 7 he says this, "Go back now, go peacefully, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." And David said to Achish, this is almost mind-boggling, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight," I can hardly read these words, "the enemies of my lord the king?" And Achish said, answered David and said, I know you are a blameless in my sight. He's been lying his head off. He is full of blame as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to battle. This is really right now the lowest of the lowest of the lowest. He is standing there with Achish, the enemy of God, saying, I'm your servant. I've been a blameless servant. I want to go up against your enemy, Israel. This is mind-boggling how he could have sunk so low. That brings us to our next point, the dangers of a backslidden child of God. You may be a child of God, and God's children can backslide and do some horrible things. The man who first discipled me as a brand new Christian, about 13 years of age, and for the next 3 years was a dear and close friend to me and many young people in our church, in our area, a wonderful servant of God, totally dedicated to young people, had many Bible studies in our home every single Friday night, took us to conferences. He just loved us and taught us and cared for us. His name was Bill Van Blark. He was a wonderful man. Well, in his local church, someone said, he was a single man, never married, said a very cruel thing about him, very cruel, made an accusation against him. It was untrue, a sexual accusation. He was so hurt by this accusation that he just turned from the Lord for the next 5 years and he sunk himself into sin. We prayed for Bill for years, and the Lord, through an accident, a very severe accident, nearly killed him, brought him back to Christ, and then he had his last years of life again serving young people and serving the Lord. But he got far, far from God. David is far from God now. There's no evidence of prayer here. There's no evidence of seeking the will of God. He is operating under discouragement and weariness, and he is not David who we saw who killed Goliath. Now, the dangers of a backslidden child of God. They can do terrible things. Break up a marriage. Create havoc in a family. Havoc in a church. David is going to feel the consequence of his sin now. So he returns. The Philistines' lords say, you cannot go with us. So he returns. Oh, probably goes, whew, I'm glad that's over. Let's go back to Ziklag, make some more raids while they're all up there. Let them all fight with one another. He returns to the city of Ziklag, and he finds a pile of ashes in front of him. While he was away, the Amalekites come. They burn the city to ground, takes his wives, takes his children, takes all of the wives of the soldiers and all their goods, and they take off with it. Imagine coming back to your city and everything's gone. Littleton's gone. Everyone you know is gone. And let's read these words, chapter 30, verse 3. And when David and his men came to the city and found that it burned with fire, and their wives and sons and daughters were taken captive, then David and the people who were with him, watch this, raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David is a broken man. He's a broken man. God has had to bring him to this point. This is divine discipline on him for taking things into his own hands and not praying about it. So you get this picture? They don't even have strength in their bodies. They don't know if they'll ever see their wives or children again. And all their goods are burned down. David's two wives also have been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. Verse 6, the key verse. And David was greatly distressed. Oh, yes, he was distressed, all right. He was stressed out. He thought when he went down to Gath that he was stressed out. Now he's really stressed out. Now look at these words. For the people spoke of stoning him. They're a great leader. Someone wrote this, loyalty and devotion he had never failed to receive from his followers was suddenly changed to vinegar and gall. They're ready to kill David. You know, they saw this whole thing as a gigantic failure. They didn't think good of it anyway, but they followed their good leader, and now they've lost everything. Because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his son and his daughter. Touch people's families and you'll find out if they're friends or not. Derek Bingham writes this of David. Displaced, disillusioned, distrusted, distressed, David at Ziklag reaches one of the lowest points of his life. Our great hero has fallen to the ground. But it was divine discipline that will turn him around. A way back to God. I'm just going to have to go another minute. I'm sorry. It's 12 noon, and I want Penny to react to us in a song. But way back to God. Let's conclude with this, and then we'll look at the big lessons next week, the big lessons. But way back, is there a way back to God? He's lost his family. His men are about ready to kill him. He has wept till he's broken. He has failed. Everyone sees this plan, this adventure has been a stone wall that splattered all over. Verse 30, chapter 30, verse 6. And David was greatly distressed. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. First time we get the name God into this story now, finally. What does that mean? It means he turns to God for strength and help. We're going to read about this in some Psalms. Comes to God. He says, I'm done. I'm broken. I'm at the end of the trail. These men are about ready to kill me. My wife, my children are gone. Verse 7, David said of Abiathar, the priest, bring me the ephod. In the old King James, says, bring hither the ephod. Spurgeon loved that phrase. Bring hither the ephod. It means bring the priestly garment of prayer and guidance. And so we read in verse 8, and David inquired of the Lord. Oh, we've got old David finally back. Prayer and seeking the will of God. F.B. Meyer says this, David sprang back to his old resting place in the bosom of God. So good. His noble self comes back. This is where he went wrong in chapter 7, chapter 27, verse 1. He, in his own heart, he planned this. Now we read in chapter 30, verse 7, he inquires of the Lord. That's what he should have done in chapter 7, verse 27, verse 1. What is the solution to this? The great lesson, we're going to go into it more next week, is that you must trust God and rest in God. I want to read to you in closing Isaiah 40, verse 28 to 31. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary. And to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and the vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait on the Lord will gain new strength. That's where he went wrong. They will mount up as wings like eagles, and they will run and not get tired, and they will walk and not be weary. The Lord Jesus said to his disciples, come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. I am gentle and humble of heart, and you shall find rest for your souls. David did not trust the promises of God. He reasoned in his own heart, and he brought all this upon his family and his friends to this low, disastrous point. The Christian life is a life of trusting and believing the words of God. No matter how we feel, no matter what the circumstances, trust in the Lord. That great, great hymn, we should sing it every day. Trust and obey. There's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. Penny, will you sing to us, and I will close in prayer.
We also want to have you join with us on the last two choruses.